I've been meaning to share my thoughts and reservations about finite theism for a while now. My views are very much in flux, so don't take this as like a last will and testament, but I realized that I was never going to be finished with this thing that I was working on, and I'd be better off if I thought of this more collaboratively, rather than trying to come to a final conclusion on my own. I've hosted two finite theism debates, one between John Buck and Alex Strasser, and another between Joseph Lawal and Dry Apologist. I'll also be releasing a conversation between Philip Goff and Graham Oppy soon on the topic as well. That'll be out in February for patrons and in March on YouTube. There was also a really interesting debate on the analytic Christian between Michael Humer and Nevin Clemenhage that I would recommend. Majesty of Reason also has a great video on finite theism. Parts of this video are based on things from that video. I'll be quoting Joe a few times. So my big picture view is roughly that limited theism is underrated, and I think the problems with unlimited theism are underestimated. I remain agnostic. I don't think finite theism is true, but I think it's a way for theism to fail less badly. A lot of this question turns on how to handle trade-offs between intrinsic probability and explanatory power or fit with the evidence. I'm skeptical of the conventional wisdom, which seems to place a lot more emphasis on intrinsic probability than how well the theory fits with the evidence, but ultimately it's very hard to know how one should manage those kinds of trade-offs. Okay, so that's roughly where I'm at. Okay, so with that, let's dive in. Most theists I know believe in creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. God to them is omnipotent. His power is without limits, with only minor caveats, but that's not the only option. Throughout history, many theists have believed that God is not totally unlimited. Perhaps his power is not absolute, maybe he's constrained by laws of nature that he had nothing to do with. One way of fleshing this out is by rejecting creation ex nihilo in favor of creation ex materia, creation out of pre-existing material. On this view, God is the creator and designer of the world, but more akin to creators that we actually have experience with. Maintaining that God created the world out of pre-existing material, stuff that already had some nature of its own, would limit God's choices. In that case, he's not just constrained by logical possibility, but also by natural or nomological possibility, at least to some degree. It's often been argued that this might help explain some amount of suffering in the world, and would be a resource for explaining suffering that's not available to theists who believe in a God with fewer limits and more degrees of freedom over his creation. Maybe it was this world or nothing. I think limitations come on a spectrum. Most theists believe that God is limited in the sense that he has to obey laws of logic, although of course many of them would quibble with that phrasing, but they are placing some limitations on God. Finite theists put more limitations on God. So this finite view of God would make God less alien and a bit more like us. Former guest Joseph Lawal has also argued that shrinking the ontological gap between God and his children in this way has advantages when it comes to philosophy of language, and that ordinary theological language like God loves us is meaningless or false on a more classical view. Arguably, the finitist ex materia view has a firmer basis in our experience of the world. It can better account for suffering, and it doesn't run the risk of making ordinary theological language false or meaningless. To me, that sounds pretty good, but a limited model of God is not without its drawbacks, so I wanted to set up a few objections to finite theism and offer some pushback. If you aren't familiar with my views, I'm not a finite theist myself, I'm an agnostic, but I take finite theism seriously because I think it has certain advantages over unlimited theism, whereas almost everyone else I know takes unlimited theism more seriously than finite theism. But for me, incurring the full wrath of the problem of evil and consequently relying on implausible theodicies to explain suffering seems like a much bigger trade-off than the costs of finite theism. Still, the problems with finite theism are serious enough that I don't believe it at the end of the day. I mean, it's still theism. It's not like this is a totally different hypothesis. If you were already convinced by various arguments from evil, hiddenness, religious discord, and so on, limiting God's power is only going to help so much. It certainly doesn't render atheism unreasonable. Still, if you ask why didn't God prevent gratuitous suffering, and they say, well, because he can't, that is a better answer than some convoluted theodicy. The problem comes when we try to flesh that answer out into a more specific theory of what God can and can't do. Still, I want to defend finite theism in some ways, for the reasons I've already mentioned. It has unique advantages over its rivals, and I think that makes it worth exploring and not dismissing out of hand for, you know, one reason or another. My suspicion is that most people have a tendency to overlook finite theism because it's at a massive cultural disadvantage. Maybe in some parallel universe where the conventional wisdom is flipped, the problems with unlimited theism would appear more acute to us than they currently do. Okay, so we can approach the first problem here as a sort of dilemma. Just how limited is the power of God? You can either give a specific answer or a non-specific answer. If you give a specific answer, that allegedly nukes the prior probability of the limited God hypothesis. If you don't give a specific answer, then that's supposed to ruin the predictive power of finite theism. So either way, you're doomed. You should never have abandoned classical Anselmian megatheism in favor of a limited God. So the argument goes. Assuming we're comparing limited theism with unlimited theism, rather than conservative naturalism or the far superior spooky naturalism, then I have a few thoughts. First, I was unaware of the spectacular predictive power of unlimited theism. Apparently, it generates very specific predictions. So, unlike a lot of non-believers, I do grant that theism makes some predictions. They are admittedly vague, but they are predictions in the sense that it obviously leads us to form some expectation about the way the world would be. For example, if we had woken up one day in Hell World and all we'd ever known was billions of years of intense agony, I think that would be incredibly powerful evidence against the hypothesis that a perfectly loving, omnipotent God created the world. If you say that theism does not generate any predictions in any sense, then nothing could count as evidence against theism. But there is evidence against theism, so it must lead us to form some expectations. In other words, theism does make predictions of a sort. It is not unfalsifiable. So there can be evidence for theism, there can be evidence against theism. Theism does make some predictions. What I'm skeptical of is the idea that unlimited theism makes significantly more specific predictions than limited theism. The second point is that to the extent that unlimited theism does make more specific predictions, those specific predictions do not align with our observations. That is a liability, not an advantage. So let's talk about the value selection hypothesis versus the hypothesis of indifference. Both forms of theism we're comparing are versions of the value selection hypothesis, on which considerations of value and disvalue can factor into the explanation of why the world is the way that it is. Panagentialism, natural teleology, and the simulation hypothesis are also versions of the value selection hypothesis, which is quite different from the ordinary naturalistic picture. On theism, there is a conscious agent who can respond to reasons for doing things, reasons for bringing about certain states of affairs. God can choose not to actualize bad states of affairs precisely because they are disvaluable. On the hypothesis of indifference, there is no constraint like that. Whatever ultimately explains why the world is the way that it is, say the known fundamental laws of physics, it's entirely indifferent to value and disvalue. The world was not set up with the welfare of conscious creatures in mind. That's the hypothesis of indifference. To me, this is the main relevant distinction that generates different predictions, albeit somewhat vague predictions. But when we stumble upon extremely valuable and improbable things that don't seem to have a natural explanation, I think those things give us some reason to favor the value selection hypothesis over the hypothesis of indifference. Theism is only one version of the value selection hypothesis, so just identifying a value selection effect, psychophysical harmony, fine-tuning, etc., is not enough to get you all the way to theism, but still, it is evidence for theism. It is also evidence for certain other versions of the value selection hypothesis. So when it comes to unlimited versus limited theism, God's power, knowledge, and rationality are very important parts of the story for explaining a value selection effect. But for me, the essential components are still there for finite theism. The mechanism, as it were, that produces a value selection effect is still there. We have a conscious agent who can respond to reasons. I can't see how moving down from all-powerful to extremely powerful, perhaps more powerful than you can fully comprehend, is supposed to nuke the predictive power of theism. It still retains some of its predictive power because the essential components of the explanation are still there. The thing that gives theism an edge over the hypothesis of indifference is still there. Now, I fully grant that prior to being born, if you were behind a veil of ignorance, you would not have been able to predict very much about the world. Probably not anything terribly specific, if all you knew was that a finite God existed. But this is also true for unlimited theism. And in one particular respect, unlimited theism is at a major disadvantage. I think unlimited theism does generate some firmer expectations about how we'd expect the world to be. For example, I would not have expected so much gratuitous suffering. That's a violated expectation. In fact, it's the main one that leads people to think about finite theism in the first place. Unlimited theism, in my view, is too unlimited of a value selection hypothesis. It leads us to expect too strong of a value selection effect. Admittedly, unlimited theism has a higher intrinsic probability than finite theism, and we'll talk more about that. Just to be clear, I'm granting that. But how on earth is it preferable to have a more specific theory when that wonderful specificity generates expectations that appear to have been violated? Having greater predictive power is obviously a desirable feature of a theory, but ideally, that greater predictive power will not yield predictions that turn out to be false. So the non-specific power level horn of the dilemma is not looking totally unacceptable to me at this point. But of course, we'd rather have a specific value, right? That brings us to the other horn of the dilemma. When you give a specific answer, that's going to seem arbitrary, and therefore annihilate the prior probability of finite theism. After all, whatever cutoff of God's power you offer, you could always ask, why that cutoff specifically, as opposed to any other conceivable cutoff? Is it just like a brute fact or something? Since we can't give a principled reason why the limitation should have that value, as opposed to the innumerable alternatives, we should treat them as having equal probability. But the alternatives are legion, so any particular one of them is going to have a really, really small probability. So, we're supposed to conclude, any limited God hypothesis that's specific enough to avoid the first horn of the dilemma is going to suffer from an incredibly small prior probability, one that is presumably so small that it couldn't be overcome. So, Philip Goff, a finite theist, likes to use the example of the speed of light. A priori, you may have had good reasons to think that an infinite value for C is preferable. The hypothesis that C is infinite may have theoretical virtues that the alternative hypothesis, that it's a finite value, does not have. It may be simpler. It may have a higher intrinsic probability. You might even think it has a much, much higher intrinsic probability. After all, why is the speed of light that exact value when it conceivably could have been so many other values? But when we make observations that appear to clash with the hypothesis that the speed of light is infinite, we don't just obstinately repeat those points. You defer to the evidence. And I think the problem of suffering is pretty damning evidence. Unfortunately, we can't observe God's limitations. It's much harder to work out what those limitations are than it was to work out the finite value of the speed of light. But imagine if the finite light theorists said that the speed of light was not infinite and didn't get any more specific than that. It's not infinite. Of course, that would not be a good theory. Ideally, you could give a specific value. But imagine if, in this scenario, that wasn't possible for whatever reason, perhaps due to crude instruments of measurement. If we had made observations that strongly suggested the speed of light was not infinite, but our instruments just weren't precise enough to give us a specific value, then I would still favor the finite light hypothesis. It's not ideal that I can't tell you what it is exactly, but I would hold out hope that someday we could do that. So again, I'm granting that it is not ideal that all we're doing is saying God's power is not infinite, just like it wouldn't be ideal to say the speed of light is finite, but I can't tell you more than that. But if we made observations that suggested the speed of light was not infinite, we should probably favor the finite light hypothesis, right? Even if we couldn't give a specific value? I don't see why the seeming arbitrariness and low intrinsic probability of the speed of light being c rather than c plus 1 or c plus 2 and so on. I just don't see why that would scare us off. Another concern I have is I don't know exactly what's being asked of the finite theist when they're told to provide a specific cutoff. What are they supposed to say? God has 86.5 power? That he has Googleplex power? Am I supposed to measure it in joules? What does a specific answer even look like when we're talking about God's power? Or human power, for that matter? The US president has a finite amount of political power, but I'm not sure how I'd go about giving a specific, let alone numerical, answer to the question of, well, since it's not infinite, where's the cutoff? Without just giving examples, right? I mean, it seems like that's what you would do. You would just give examples of things that they can do and things they can't do. With God, we'd similarly make observations about the natural world and try to reverse engineer his limits. I don't know why that's treated with suspicion. But anyway, I would like some clarity on the kind of answer that's being sought out here. Do you want a quantitative answer? A more qualitative answer? I'm not posing these as unanswerable questions, by the way. I'm seeking some clarity here. What kind of answer are you looking for? In any case, the finite theist is not going to have a terribly specific answer to the question, how much power does God have exactly? It's extremely vast, but it's finite. Given that, I'm not convinced that the limited God hypothesis does suffer a tremendous hit to its prior probability, but still, in reality, God will have some more specific degree of power, and you could level the same arbitrariness objection. Michael Humer on his Substack makes a point about this, quote, I don't think that the arbitrariness point is right. If I had a theory that required God to have some very specific amount of power, then you could say that it was initially improbable just because there is an infinite range of possible amounts of power, with no a priori reason why the Creator's power should have been one particular value. But I don't require that. I'm just proposing that the Creator, if there is one, had some very large but finite amount of power. That covers a vast range of possibilities, so that should have a pretty high prior. Of course, whatever the Creator's actual degree of power and other specific properties, even if we don't know what it is, it will be some very specific value, and there will be a question of why it should be that value rather than any other value, and maybe there will be no answer to that. It just happens to be that way. But I think this is just how contingent reality is. Whenever you get a precise description of any contingent aspect of reality, you can ask why it is that way, rather than any of the many other ways it could have been. Sometimes, often, you can trace it back to some other contingent fact that caused the first fact, but there's no ultimate way of avoiding brute facts that just are the way they are, and I don't see what's wrong with that. I don't see why I should think a priori that the world probably won't be like that. End quote. So that's one big reason why I don't see the arbitrariness inherent to the limited God as especially damning. I was under the impression that brute facts were unavoidable. Yes, they are undesirable, in a theoretical sense, but I also think they're kind of inevitable. And if that's the case, and we want our worldview to be accurate, then we should learn to love whatever brute facts we're compelled to accept. Maybe I'm wrong that brute facts are unavoidable, but if they are unavoidable, then you are guaranteed to be led astray if your allergy to bruteness is too severe. Humer also argues that the intrinsic probability of infinite power is potentially much lower than unlimited theists believe, so I would read his post if you want the story on that. He also covers it briefly in his debate with Nevin Clemenhage. On the point about predictive power, though, it might sound like a very informative answer to say that God's power is infinite, but I'm not sure how that generates far more specific predictions than the finite theist saying that God is extraordinarily powerful, he's the most powerful being in the universe, but it's not like he can do anything that's logically possible. Okay, but what predictions specifically are borne out by entering an infinity sign as your answer as opposed to the finitist answer? Maybe you can point to a difference, but I would also need to see that it grants the unlimited theist a non-negligible advantage to care about that difference. And to reiterate, I can think of at least one major difference with respect to suffering that clearly does not favor the unlimited theism option, since those expectations do not line up with what we observe. However, I want to flag that there are trade-offs here. In this case, the trade-offs are between intrinsic probability and explanatory power. how are we to evaluate these trade-offs? No one knows. But I think this problem of low intrinsic probability is potentially a very big issue for finite theism. I know I'm kind of minimizing it here, but I want to give the problem its due. It is a real problem, okay? I'm trying to push back against the unlimited theist's confidence here. This is Majesty of Reason.
You're going to considerably lower the probability of your hypothesis by virtue of its significant arbitrariness. Why that cutoff specifically, as opposed to any of the countless conceivable other cutoffs? None of the cutoffs seem more natural or more principled or less arbitrary than the others, and so it seems like we should treat them equally in terms of the probability we assign to a god having any one of the cutoffs. But since there are vastly many such cutoffs, this means the prior probability of a limited god hypothesis that's sufficiently specific to enjoy predictive power is going to be extraordinarily small. In fact, limited god hypotheses might have vanishingly small prior probabilities. To see why, consider two theories. The no-limit theory says that the fundamental laws of physics apply everywhere in the universe. There is no limit to their application. By contrast, the limit theory says that the fundamental laws of physics apply everywhere in the universe except for some extremely tiny region at the outskirts of the galaxy, on the outskirts of the observable universe. Now, most of us, including physicists, think that the no-limit theory is far more likely than the limit theory. But notice that our empirical evidence is about equally good for both of them. If there's just one astronomically small and far-out region governed by different equations or no equations at all, then it's overwhelmingly unlikely that we would have found it. And so our observations of the uniform applicability of the fundamental laws of physics are only overwhelmingly weak evidence for the no-limit theory over the limit theory. So then, if we really are justified in thinking the no-limit theory is far more probable than the limit theory, it's because of something about the no-limit theory compared to the limit theory prior to taking any empirical evidence into account, since the empirical evidence only negligibly favors the no-limit theory. In other words, the prior, or more accurately, intrinsic probability of the no-limit theory must be far greater than that of the limit theory. By the way, a prior probability of hypothesis is just the probability of the hypothesis prior to looking at a particular piece of evidence. The intrinsic probability of hypothesis is just the probability of the hypothesis prior to looking at any empirical evidence whatsoever. So again, the intrinsic probability of the no-limit theory, it seems, must be far greater than that of the limit theory.
I've heard this example used many times to support the idea that we should think God's power is infinite. The same arbitrariness of the limit theory is also present in the limited God hypothesis, so we ought to think it also has a very low intrinsic probability. So far, I've been assuming a certain amount of background knowledge about probability stuff, but we should probably take a step back if we're going to fully appreciate this objection to finite theism. So here's a standard question about probability. If a test to detect a disease whose prevalence is 1 in 1,000 has a false positive rate of 5%, what is the chance that a person found to have a positive result actually has the disease, assuming you know nothing else about the case? So just to repeat that, if a test to detect a disease whose prevalence is 1 in 1,000 has a false positive rate of 5%, what is the chance that a person found to have a positive test result actually has the disease, assuming you know nothing else about the case? So according to a 2014 article in the British Medical Journal, fewer than 1 out of 5 participants in one survey, who were all doctors or medical students at Harvard teaching hospitals, got the correct answer. Most of them thought there was a 95% chance that the patient with the positive result had the disease, since the false positive rate was 5%. But the right answer is not 95%. It's actually about 2%. The prevalence of the disease is 1 in 1,000. Only 1 out of 1,000 will be a true positive. But since there's a false positive rate of 5%, then about 50 out of 1,000 will be false positives. So out of 51 positive test results, only one will be a true positive. So that leaves the probability of a true positive around 2%. And for what it's worth, if this were a real case, you would just want to run the test a few more times to rule out a false positive. Every positive result increases the odds. And in real life, we would know whether there were other symptoms and risk factors. We would have multiple lines of evidence, in other words. As we'd expect, nearly everyone who does not have the disease tests negative. Yes, false positives occur, but if you don't have the disease, the odds are overwhelming that you would test negative. On the hypothesis that the patient doesn't have the disease, the positive result is surprising. It's not what you'd have predicted. So in this scenario, if the patient does have the disease, it's not surprising at all. It's to be expected on that hypothesis. The positive result is a matter of course. If you ran an apologetics channel for the hypothesis that the patient had the disease, you'd make 500 videos about the positive test result, as it is evidence in favor of your view. So the lesson here is that the prior probability changes everything. If we didn't know the prevalence of the disease was 1 in 1,000, we would be groping in the dark trying to work out the overall probability that the patient had the disease. Now, that doesn't change that the positive test is evidence that the patient has the disease, but you could easily get carried away and think that the probability is 95% or something like that, when in reality, it turns out to be more like 2%. In his new book on the problem of evil, Paul Draper uses the analogy of a foot race. Say there are two runners who are equally fast, roughly speaking. They're going to compete in the 100-yard dash, but one of them gets to start on the 10-yard line. Well, that one is probably going to win, not by being faster, but by starting closer to the finish line. Say that one of them started on the 95-yard line. Well, that one is definitely going to win. So even if the evidence between the two theories is roughly counterbalanced, the two runners run equally fast, or even if the evidence favors one theory over the other, you can try to figure out where they started, and that would decide which is the better theory. Okay, so given the fact that the priors change everything, and can even flip your reflexive judgment on its head, it would be a major problem if we didn't know what the priors were. I can know that the prevalence of a disease is 1 in 1,000 before I administer a test for that disease, but before I examine some evidence for or against theism, how am I supposed to have a prior probability on hand?
Hey, so I thought I would just jump in here because it's actually really simple. First, you just need to... And that's how you determine where you're starting from with every metaphysical theory of reality.
In Draper's new book, he defends his view of intrinsic probability, which would inform our priors. The prior probability is roughly the probability of a hypothesis before we take into account some particular piece of evidence. The intrinsic probability is the probability of a hypothesis before we take into account any evidence. According to Draper, what determines the intrinsic probability is the theory's modesty and coherence. That is, how much the theory asserts and how well its assertions fit with each other. Additionally, he claims that these two factors and only these two factors determine intrinsic probability. Quote, "The intrinsic probability of a hypothesis is the epistemic probability a hypothesis has by virtue of its intrinsic features. In other words, it is the credence one ought to assign to a proposition simply by virtue of what it says and what one knows by rational intuition, ignoring any incremental evidence one has for or against it. Thus, intrinsic epistemic probabilities, like all epistemic probabilities, will vary from one person to another, because what one knows by rational intuition will vary from one person to another. By incremental evidence for or against a hypothesis, I mean, roughly, observation reports that raise or lower the probability of that hypothesis being true. Some philosophers claim that if we put aside such evidence, then we're left with initial probabilities that are purely subjective. I claim, in opposition to this popular view, that there are at least some substantial rational constraints on such probabilities, beyond consistency with the rules of mathematical probability. I agree that these constraints are rarely robust enough to generate numerical probabilities of this sort, though they sometimes do. My position, however, is that interesting and objectively true comparative judgments of intrinsic epistemic probability are common." End quote. So if you're someone who is skeptical of this entire notion of intrinsic probability, then Draper seems to have alluded to an easy escape route for the finite theist. We're left with initial probabilities that are purely subjective. And Draper says this is a popular view, which I'll take his word for. Well, if that's true, then in the case of theism, there is no correct prior probability of God's existence, not like it's objectively the case that the prevalence of a disease is 1 in 1,000. So I'm not at all confident that that is a viable route to take. We've actually already covered the reason why in discussing the limit versus no limit theory of the fundamental laws of physics. So compare the theory that the fundamental laws apply everywhere in the universe versus the theory that they apply everywhere except one microscopic region trillions of light years away. The evidence that we've actually gathered is equally supportive of both theories, since they yield identical predictions as far as we're concerned. At most, you could say the evidence favors the no-limit theory very, very negligibly. And yet, we think one of them is ridiculous, and the other one is very reasonable. Why is that? Well, since there is no significant difference in the extrinsic factors, then there must be a difference in their intrinsic features. The difference didn't come after taking evidence into account, so there must be some difference in their probability prior to taking any evidence into account. Any of us would think it was irrational if a person didn't strongly favor the no-limit theory. So, roughly speaking, that's why I think intrinsic probability is a thing. You can come up with these hypotheticals where you have two theories that don't differ extrinsically, and yet one of them seems pretty reasonable and the other one seems ridiculous. Well, they don't differ in their extrinsic features, so they must differ in their intrinsic features. As Draper puts it, quote, "How is it that one hypothesis can be objectively more probable than another hypothesis relative to some epistemic situation, even though factors extrinsic to those hypotheses favor neither of the two hypotheses over the other?" By objectively more probable, I mean that rationality requires anyone in that situation to give one hypothesis greater credence than the other. I do not mean that the probabilities are mind-independent. The only plausible, or for that matter possible, solution to this riddle is that one of the hypotheses is more probable than the other by virtue of its intrinsic features. To use a sports metaphor, if two sprinters leave the blocks simultaneously, run parallel to each other at the same velocity, and yet one wins the race, then the winner must have started closer to the finish line. If, however, this higher starting probability is not the result of extrinsic factors, then it must be a consequence of factors intrinsic to the hypothesis. Therefore, one hypothesis must be more probable intrinsically than the other. End quote. So, as I said, I think that's a pretty good reason to think that intrinsic probability is a thing in the first place. Although, whether Draper's particular theory of intrinsic probability is correct is a different question, still, I don't think we should be excessively skeptical of talk of the intrinsic probability of theism, even if we can't assign a specific numerical value with a high degree of confidence. One thing we can do is assign hypothetical numbers and see how it plays out. We can assume the prior probability is A, B, or C and figure it out from there. This may shock you, but if it's low, the overall probability goes down, and if it's high, the number goes up. Pretty crazy. So it's typically thought that brute limitations impose a cost to the intrinsic probability of finite theism, at least in part because of their arbitrariness. There are many possible ways God's power could have been limited. Why those specific limits? Bruteness, unexplained complexity, arbitrariness, non-uniformity, contingency, etc. I tend to think these things will harm the intrinsic probability of a hypothesis in many cases. Derek Parfit once wrote an article called "Why Anything? Why This?" And I've always loved that title. It couldn't be more succinct, and it poses two of the deepest, most fundamental questions about existence. So keep that question in mind as we go into this next section, because I think it'll be a good anchoring point. I've been trying to convince you that intrinsic probability is real, but I don't have a complete theory of how to work it out. And even if I had clear criteria, and we knew that they were the right criteria, it probably wouldn't be trivial to know how to apply them. As for finite theism, I don't really dispute that it has a lower intrinsic probability than unlimited theism, which is comparatively very simple. The question is, how much lower is the intrinsic probability? Does it drop a nuke on it, irradiating everyone in the blast radius with pure reason? Or does it just lower it? I lean towards the latter view, in part because I think overestimating the importance of intrinsic probability runs the risk of becoming irrationally biased against complexity, bruteness, arbitrariness, etc. As I mentioned earlier, it's not that these are wonderful, desirable features of a theory, it's that our world appears to give us many examples of complexity and so on. It's a recipe for being continually baffled by the world right in front of your eyes. So just look at the world around you. I mean, it's worth remembering that the world is completely absurd. Bringing up low intrinsic probability is not a showstopper. Like I said, total skepticism about intrinsic probability would be misguided, but I think that it can militate against any arbitrariness and any complexity to such a degree that you would be baffled by any amount of it. That's a problem because the world is obviously quite complex, and it seems like it could have been quite different. To quote Humer again, there will be a question of why it should be that value rather than any other value, and maybe there will be no answer to that. It just happens to be that way. But I think this is just how contingent reality is. Whenever you get a precise description of any contingent aspect of reality, you can ask why it is that way rather than any of the other many ways it could have been. Sometimes, often, you can trace it back to another contingent fact that caused the first fact, but there's no ultimate way of avoiding brute facts that just are the way they are. And I don't see what's wrong with that. I don't see why I should think a priori that the world probably won't be like that. Why this? Why is it this way instead of some other way? That's a legitimate question. But it seems that this kind of reasoning taken too far is going to lead you to think that fundamental reality has to be one way. It seems like that's what you're after, right? But now we have to ask why this simple fundamental thing brings about all this other stuff that naturalists mistakenly identify as fundamental. There are so many possibilities. And it's so arbitrary that it went with this natural world instead of the expanse of other choices. Graham Oppie raises a similar point in The Best Argument Against God. What naturalists will sometimes take as brute facts in their theories correspond to free choices made by God that appear similarly brute. Of all the things that God could have chosen, why did he choose this over that? Why did it bring about this natural world when there could have been so many other things? Why this? You might ask whether any progress has actually been made here with respect to bruteness and arbitrariness. So I'm not really convinced that this sort of answer solves the problem so much as it just relocates the problem. Like they say, you push the lump down in the carpet and it just comes up in another spot. Maybe that's what's going on here. Of course, no one thinks intrinsic probability is everything. You can have a low intrinsic probability and a high, all things considered, probability. But that's kind of my point. It seems way too hasty to me to dismiss finite theism because it has a lower intrinsic probability than unlimited theism. So I think it's one of two things. It either doesn't have a much lower intrinsic probability, or it does, but that fact doesn't matter so much that it should be considered a dead option. So let's return to the problem of evil briefly. This is supposed to be one of the main advantages for finite theism. And maybe it is, but limiting God's power doesn't come without a price tag. I've brought this up many times, but it's hard to square common miracle claims with the idea that pointless suffering on earth is an unfortunate result of God's finite power. So he's powerful enough to part the Red Sea, but not to stop hurricanes that drown the elderly in their homes. He's powerful enough to multiply loaves and fishes, but not to prevent the mass starvation of animals over the eons of evolutionary history. He's powerful enough to do whatever it is that people think he did at Fatima, but he can't intervene and shutter a few pediatric oncology wards. If I became a finite theist, I would remain incredibly skeptical of miracles. I mean, I think I'd have to. If he's powerful enough to perform these sorts of miracles, I don't see why his limitations help explain evil at all. Maybe someone could come up with a plausible account of how his power works, such that they could make these things fit together. You know, there are different kinds of power after all, but I'm not that hopeful. On the flip side, the unlimited theist has a much more difficult question to answer regarding those problems, precisely because their God is unlimited. I've also heard it suggested that finite theism can help explain divine hiddenness, but there's a similar tension here. He's capable of causing religious experiences, right? Why can't he cause a religious experience for non-resistant non-believers? You're just going to fall back on the exact kinds of explanations that the unlimited theist wants to use. This raises a further question for the finite theist. Without the traditional arguments for God, why would you believe in God in the first place? I ask because finite theists can't help themselves to all of the arguments for theism on offer. First, maybe belief in God can be rational without arguments. I think the religious believer should certainly want to say that. After all, most believers throughout history could not give any good evidentialist case for their religious views. So do you want to say that virtually every Christian in history was irrational for believing in God or being a Christian, just because they couldn't defend the Kalam cosmological argument? Do you think the vast majority of believers, past and present, are and have been unjustified in accepting their belief in God? If you're an atheist, then you're free to say that, but if you're a Christian, I doubt you'd want to commit yourself to that. If religious experience and the witness of the Holy Spirit in your heart works for unlimited theists, then what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Second, there are plenty of arguments that finite theists can use, like design arguments. They can't use the ontological argument, which is awful news because everyone loves that argument. Some finite theists believe in an eternal universe, so they can't use the Kalam argument, another famously flawless argument that has no problems whatsoever. So those two are out, and for me, those two arguments were the cornerstone of my Christian faith. We learned about the ontological argument every week in Sunday school, and it was really when I read Kant's critique that it all started to fall apart for me. And for the record, it's not like I hate natural theology. This would take more unpacking, but other arguments like fine-tuning and psychophysical harmony can be used by finite theists. It is possible. But I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask the finite theist to explain why God is powerful enough to do X, Y, and Z, but not powerful enough to decrease evolutionary animal suffering. Philip Goff argues that there are different kinds of power, so it's not necessarily a question of balancing God's degree of power on a knife edge. That sounds more promising to me, but I'd still need to hear more about how that works exactly. Earlier, I mentioned creation ex materia. You could raise a similar objection to that understanding of God and nature that we've been discussing, namely arbitrariness and low intrinsic probability. If God created the world out of pre-existing material, and this accounts for some of God's limitations with respect to creating any world he'd like, then we can focus not only on God's nature, but also the nature of this pre-existing material. I heard Joe Schmid raise this objection to a finite theist. This pre-existing material has a particular nature rather than some other nature. Conceivably, it could have been disposed to create nothing but octagons, or ducks, or electrons, and so on and so forth. God was fortunate to have found pre-existing material that could be used in his act of creation and design to make anything interesting at all. But say that God found himself in an eternal universe where panagentialism is true. That's pretty lucky for God. If there were innumerable conscious agents just waiting to be molded by God in his image, well, that's good news for us and for God. There are so many other ways this primeval stuff could have been. And while it's difficult for me to imagine panpsychism being false, there are, I suppose, other ways things could have been. So why doesn't this dramatically lower the intrinsic probability of this idea of God and nature? Well, it does, for all the reasons that we've been talking about. And all the mitigating considerations apply equally as well. Like, of course it lowers its intrinsic probability. What I'm worried about is overestimating how much it's lowered, such that you end up continually bewildered by contingency and bruteness on pretty much any level. And I'm skeptical that the trade-off should be caring way more about intrinsic probability than fit with the evidence. I guess one way of putting this, I'm against dismissing different theories of reality in virtue of the fact that there are very many ways reality could have been. I do think intrinsic probability is a thing, and by certain plausible accounts of it, like Draper's, unlimited theism comes out way better than finite theism. What's kind of funny to me is that I think people will have heard very different episodes today depending on how they view finite theism. I've been trying to explain why I don't think a nuclear bomb has been dropped on finite theism, but that's consistent with thinking these are still serious problems. Still, I suppose it might sound like I've been saying contradictory things today, so let me reiterate my position. I am not a finite theist. Despite this fact, I think it is too often dismissed too quickly, and I think its problems are somewhat overestimated, and the problems with unlimited theism severely underestimated. I think finite theism arguably handles the problem of evil better than unlimited theism. If God just can't prevent certain evils, as Philip Goff often says, if it's this or nothing, then you don't need tortured theodicies. Second, it preserves value selection. Finite theism still says that reality is shaped by a conscious agent, responding to reasons. It also avoids linguistic weirdness, Classical theism makes everyday religious language like God loves us either incoherent or false. Ordinary theological language kind of breaks down when the gap between God and humans becomes too vast. Finite theism shrinks that gap. I'm ultimately not a finite theist because of its low intrinsic probability, and because I don't think it can convincingly resolve the problem of evil without making a bunch of other trade-offs. Like I said, at the end of the day, this is still theism. When we talk about God's limitations, we can either be specific, then the answer looks arbitrary, which lowers the theory's intrinsic and therefore prior probability. If we're non-specific, it loses some predictive power, but ultimately I think the non-specific answer is a totally acceptable horn of the dilemma, like Humer explained. I don't think this dilemma really, like, destroys finite theism. I do think that brute facts may be unavoidable. Unlimited theism is not free of arbitrariness, you know, when it comes to God's free choices and why did he create this world rather than another? Why did he create it all? I've been kind of beating up on finite theism a bit, at least to my mind. Like I said, I think people will have heard different episodes depending on how sympathetic they are to finite theism. But I thought I would shift gears a bit and end with a story. So first, I should mention that I do think the Bible is fairly consistent with a finite God. I think a finite God creating ex materia is more consistent with the Bible than classical theism, and not just by a little. I didn't mention this until now because I don't really care as much about historical and exegetical questions as I do about philosophical considerations, but that's my opinion, for whatever it's worth. So with that in mind, here's a story from my life. When I was very young, I somehow got it in my head that my dad was the tallest man in the world. He is very tall, he's about 6'7". Nobody told me he was the tallest man in the world. I have no idea how this thought burrowed into my mind. Kids have all sorts of strange notions like this, and who knows where they come from. But one day, I saw an even taller man in the store. I was alarmed by this. My dad was with me, and I asked him, "How tall is that guy? Is he taller than you?" And I asked him this very quietly, so he had to lean down to hear me. He straightened back up, looked over, and shrugged his shoulders and said, "Yeah, probably." I was devastated. I was crushed. This was the worst news I'd ever gotten in my life. I was also angry at my dad. I don't know why, but my reaction was to start pouting. Now, consider the completely absurd situation my father was in at that moment. His idiot son got it in his head that he was the tallest man in the world. He does not even know that I think this, and if he did, he would not know why I think this. And now, I'm mad at him for not being something that he never told me he was, and is completely insane to believe. So, you know how I feel about classical theism, and if God delivered us the Bible and it's an inspired text filled with revelation and divine wisdom, God did basically nothing to give us the impression that classical theism is true. Then, we somehow, inexplicably, came to the conclusion that he has several attributes that make zero sense, that they're all identical to each other, and some of us get very upset if anyone challenges this in any way. Some would say that anyone who rejects it is an atheist. Maybe we just need to get over these sorts of ideas. If God exists, I don't think he ever told anyone that he was actus purus or that all his properties are identical to each other, or that he is a being than which none greater can be conceived. I mean, I think in the Bible the closest you'll find is name above all names. These superlative versions of theism came about when a small number of humans came up with them on their own fairly recently. So despite the problems with finite theism, I can't help but feel that it's a little more realistic. It paints a picture of a heavenly father who loves us, is like us, and in all likelihood wants you to smash that like button, become a patron, and tell your friends about the channel. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll see you next time.